This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Auto insurance can all seem the same until it comes time to use it. So don't get stuck paying more for less coverage. Switch to USAA Auto Insurance and you could start saving money in no time. Get a quote today. Restrictions apply.
Hi, this is Leland Sklar, and you are digging Pantheon Podcast.
Yes!
Pantheon Podcast presents Deeper Digs with host and rock and roll archaeologist Christian Swain. Music, culture, technology, and rock and roll. Now, on with the show.
Well, I'm standing next to a mountain, chop it down with the edge of my hand. Pick up the pieces, make an island, might even raise a little sand. We are definitely in the house of the gods today, folks. In fact, we're going to be here for a couple of Deeper Dig episodes because I am working with an upcoming Jimi Hendrix celebration that is going to be on November 27th, 2020, which would have been Jimmy's 78th birthday. In a minute, I'll give you diggers all the details, so hold tight. Today, we have two fantastic guests, drummer Kenny Aronoff and author Corey Washington. All right, quick business. Did everybody survive the elections? Or election? I think it's still sort of going on, maybe? I don't know. Not really, but there's constant news items that are out there. Well, hey, you know, I hope whoever you voted for and whatever you voted for, because everybody has other issues wherever that you may live, I hope it all worked out for you. Or if not, hey, you know, in 2 years, there's a whole nother national election. And in four, there's another one for president. So, you know, keep the powder dry for the future if things didn't go as planned. And if they have, well, you know, it's hopefully we can get some stuff done in the positive. I mean, certainly on the pandemic side, we got to do something. This is what we're going through and what we're doing is definitely not working. We got almost 250,000 people dead. That is not good. 10 million infections. That's something ain't working. Something's not right. So, all right. Enough of that. Moving on. Please go to Pantheon Podcasts for new shows. We got a couple of new ones that I'll highlight here. The Crime and Music Podcast. Yes, we need a Crime and Music Podcast. Brian Kinsley and Benjamin Ruppel, who met in second grade, started this show in April of 2018. The podcast became a great way for the guys to hang out again after being apart from each other for a while and to explore their comedic creativity with their unique musical backgrounds. Thanks to some eBay selling and buying, converting a storage room into a professional podcast studio only took a bit of time and a few hours of, how-to videos on YouTube. I love those things. So every other Wednesday, Pantheon is proud to present this new music history true crime podcast about people in and around the music business and their misadventures in lawbreaking. So go check that one out, Crime in Music Podcast. The Hustle, Music and Money, which is hosted by John Lamoureux. John asks the question, what does it take to maintain a career in music? He tracks down members of bands that flirted with stardom and find out what their lives are like now. Every artist has a story, whether big or small. They've all seen the ups and downs and worked hard to maintain careers in music. John chats with some of the most interesting legacy artists in pop music and go in depth on their career, how they feel about them and what it's like being a rock star, and also hear their best stories. If you are a music junkie, you will love these long-form conversations with beloved figures from your life. All right. Listener-supported button at Pantheon. Please go and check that out, pantheonpodcast.com. And if you hit the listener-supported button at the top, you can go to Patreon, and we appreciate you Patreon members out there. Thank you so much. You can go to TeePublic and pick up some Rock and Roll Archaeology swag, some Deeper Dig swag, some Pantheon swag. We're building that that store up, so take a look if you haven't in a while. And now you can just buy us a cup of coffee, or coffee, as they like to say. Coffee. So, you know, that's one of those one-time tips, if you will. And that can all be found at pantheonpodcast.com. All right, that's the news. Let's get to it. Let's do this. Well, I'll stand up next to a mountain, and I'll chop it down with the edge of my hand. Okay, diggers, we have a very special November coming for all of you. On Friday, November 27th at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 4 p.m. out on the Pacific Coast, if you're here, Kiss the Sky presents a live stream of their annual Jimi Hendrix Birthday Bash direct from the historic Bearsville Theater in Woodstock, New York. Now, see why Rolling Stone magazine has said, yes, believe the hype, this show lives up to it. And why Access TV crowned Kiss the Sky featuring left-handed guitar virtuoso Jimmy Blue the world's greatest tribute to Jimi Hendrix. Kiss the Sky recreates Hendrix's most iconic concert moments in full replica wardrobe and gear so well that they have had the honor of playing with all surviving members of Hendrix's own bands, including Billy Cox, The Last Gypsy. Check out the Bearsville Theater and or at Kiss the Sky tribute pages on Facebook for more information. So bearsvilletheater.com and then Kiss the Sky tribute page on Facebook for more info on where you can get tickets. Hey, this is a donate only to check it out. So it's free if you want, but I've seen Jimmy Blue, and I'm certain you all will be willing to pass a few bucks his way. But I like the idea of making it up to you. Very cool. It's kind of like the coffee thing I was just talking about. Tips, you know? So go check it out, the 27th. It'll be fun. In honor of this upcoming event, I am going to be interviewing several greats who played with Jimmy, were inspired by Jimmy, or dove into how Jimmy fits in the rock and roll pantheon. Today, we've got two guests for you. In fact, to pull this off, all these upcoming Hendrix shows will have two guests, and all of it will focus on Jimi Hendrix. Corey Washington is an author with a new book called Jimi Hendrix, Black Legacy, A Dream Deferred. And he'll be second. I'll come back to give a fuller explanation of this important book and who Corey is. But up first, to kick off this, is the amazingly all-around talented drummer Kenny Aronoff. Voted one of the top 100 drummers of all time by Rolling Stone magazine, Drummer Magazine has crowned Kenny Aronoff the number one pop rock drummer and the number one studio drummer for his unique and emulated style, combining both finesse and power. The celebrated musician has contributed his talents to more than 60 Grammy-nominated recordings. Over 300 million records sold worldwide feature his work, 1,300 of which are certified gold, platinum, or diamond records. Dude is a serious stud. Kenny has learned countless lessons over his four-decade career in show business, taking what was once a dream and turning it into an awe-inspiring reality. He has transformed his foundations of hard work and dedication into a message of achievement and inspiration that he shares with audiences worldwide. Yes, you too can book Kenny Aronoff for a speaking tour. And by the way, Kenny is one of those guys that is just, it has charisma all over him. He when he speaks, people listen. And you'll see in this short interview that I did with him, I love the guy. In his autobiography, Sex, Drums, Rock and Roll, Kenny Aronoff talks about his childhood growing up in both the Berkshires and the Midwest. At an early age, music inspired him. He studied classical, jazz, and every style in between, creating a foundation that evolved into the versatile drummer that he is today, with the talent to play anything. While trying to make it in the music business in his early 20s, fate stepped in with the audition that would change his life. It was for John Mellencamp. His work with Mellencamp catapulted Aronoff to the top of the charts with hits like Hurt So Good, Little Pink Houses, and Jack and Diane, paving the way for session and recording work for many remarkable artists. Today, we are going to be focusing on what Hendrix meant to him, and I won't spoil it, but Kenny is definitely the guy to kick this celebration off with. All right, all right, all right. You are about to get a highly nutritious diet of Jimi Hendrix over the next few weeks. So let's get the party started. Here is Kenny Aronoff. You jump in front of my car when you know all the time. 90 miles an hour, girl, is the speed I drive. You tell me it's all right. You don't mind a little pain. You say you just want me to take you for a drive. You're just like welcome to Deeper Digs, Kenny Aronoff. How are you doing today?
I'm great, man. Thanks for having me.
Oh, always excited to talk to somebody like yourself. You know, I, the first question has to be asked is, how are you doing during COVID, and how has this affected your livelihood?
I'm killing it. I lost the Joe Satriani tour. That record had entered the charts at number 8 on Billboard. John Fogerty touring and Supersonic Blue Machine, which is a band I have where we feature Billy Gibbons and people like that. So all that went away, and all my speaking events that I had went away. But I did do my first virtual speaking event from my studio, Uncommon Studios, like about 2 weeks ago. So I am up and running, which is a lot goes into that with this TV monitors, lighting, different cameras, switchers, sound, and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
So I'm in my studio every day, Uncommon Studios, LA, and I record. I mean, I'm about to do something for, Edgar Winter. He's doing a record to honor Johnny Winter. I've done stuff, just did Axis TV with Sammy Hagar and Steve Lukather. They actually did an episode that was on TV last Sunday.
Oh, what a Sammy's Roadshow.
It was right from my studio, right from my studio. We have all, I've got all the gear and the equipment for that. I've got all kinds of records. I'm going to start a new Satriani record in my studio. I've got all kinds of unsigned acts and all kinds of people sending me stuff. And I'm constantly working on my speaking business. I am so busy. I'm busier now than I am when I'm on the road, because there's only so many things I can do when I'm touring. And I'm the type of guy that when I go back to my room after a show, I work till 1 to 4 in the morning on my other stuff. But this is insane. And, you know, you got to stay physically, mentally, spiritually, and emotionally strong. And I have a whole program on how to do that. And, you know, I'm busy, man. I am slammed busy.
That's so great to hear. You know, a lot of people that we've talked to, you know, I mean, you know, touring was just so incredibly important to their world, and it all disappeared overnight. And, you know, we're all having to wonder when that will ever come back. But so glad to hear that things are going okay for you in the age of COVID.
I'd say okay. It was great, actually. monetarily it's different, of course, I'm killing it, man. The thing is, I'm a soldier. I'm a Marine, and when or a Navy SEAL, I should say. And what you do is, when something when you get into an, you have to embrace adversity immediately. Yeah. And I just made a list of what I was planning to do this year, and I replaced it immediately with things. And within 24 hours, I had started to go like, can't do that, so now I'm going to do this. Can't do that, I'm going to do this. Can't do that, and I'm going to do this. Okay, how am I going to do with those financial things? And eventually, I figured it out. Now,
worry about only the things you can control, basically. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, the thing is I've always been this guy. When John Mellencamp, at the end of 8 years of touring the USA in our own private jet and selling out arenas everywhere with no opening act, and we were one of the biggest bands in America, and he decides to take 3 years off, in 24 hours I had a plan, and that was, listen, I've been working for one rock star for 8 years. Now I'm going to go work with all the other rock stars.
And you have.
And I have. And I mean, there is nobody. Dude,
Now, you're one of the hardest working men in show business. Yeah, definitely.
Well, I broke rules. I mean, look at the same guy who records with Johnny Cash, Willie Nelson, Kris Kristofferson, Waylon Jennings, does not usually go on tour with the Smashing Pumpkins, and then plays with Ray Charles, Buddy Guy, B.B. King, or then jumps over and does, you know, like Michelle Branch, Alanis Morissette, Avril Lavigne, Celine Dion. But that same guy does the Meatloaf records and then also plays with the Buddy Rich Big Band and also performed with the Boston Symphony Orchestra that got a job in the Jerusalem Symphony Orchestra. But then that's the same guy who did 75 Letterman shows and six Saturday Night Live shows. And then I'm off with Tony Iommi from Sabbath and Glenn Hughes starting our own band. And then next thing you know, I'm playing with Jerry Lee Lewis and Little Richard at the Grammys with Fogerty. Usually you are one guy or the other guy.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Somehow
you get pigeonholed. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you definitely get pigeonholed.
Yeah.
Somehow I got hired and I just kept, I'm doing it just for fun. I'm connecting the dots now. I'm looking back because when I wrote my autobiography, Sex, Drums, Rock and Roll, they were asking me pointed questions to market the book, and I had to come up with these statistics or these facts, and suddenly I went, holy shit. And as a speaker, you have corporate audiences that they don't really know. It's like I'm the guy, the most famous guy you don't know. It's like I'm everywhere. I'm the most viewed guy literally on
Action. Oh yeah, TV. Yeah, yeah.
But they're like,
anybody sees you, they go, I know that guy. Where do I know that guy? Right. Oh, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The most famous guy you don't know. And my mom said, that was in an article once, a title in Esquire. And she goes, I can't believe they said that. I said, Mom, it's the truth, though.
No. And to be honest with you, it's an enviable position because now you do get to slide in wherever you want without bringing, you know, all of the baggage. If you were like super famous, that would have to go along with it.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It's like John Fogerty. He can only be John
Fogerty. Yeah,
but I can play with 100 John Fogertys and it's okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Enviable position. So let's talk a little bit about our subject matter today. I think like a lot of kids, in that age bracket, you know, February 9th, 1964 was the night that changed your life. And you said, holy shit, what is that? And I want to do that, right?
Absolutely. Ed Sullivan Show. The Beatles, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I was just playing outside. I was 10 years old. My mom screamed at us. I grew up in New England and like an old dairy farm, and there was nothing to watch on TV. We were just running around being crazy outside, my brother and I. And mom yelled at us from the porch, says, get in here right now. And I thought, oh, shit, I'm in trouble, which was usually the case. And, I came into the family room on this black and white RCA TV set with antenna and rabbit ears, to get better reception than there were the Beatles. And so, I didn't know who they were, and I'd never seen rock and roll before, but I knew immediately that's what I wanted to do, and I was electrified. And before I even understand what these words mean, I realized what my purpose in life was. I didn't even know what that meant. All I know is I wanted to do it. And so... Yeah, and obviously, 50 years later, I'm playing with them, honoring them for that show.
Yeah, including, I think you've played with both Sir Paul and Ringo.
Yeah, both of them I did. Yeah. Yep, yeah. Both of them. And I'd done the Grammys the night before with Ringo. Uh-huh. I mean, and I was hanging with them, talking, and I'd met Paul before. Mm-hmm. I was doing an Alice Cooper record once, and It was just me, the engineer and a producer, and I was doing four tracks a day. I write every note out, and you know, and so I was just writing what they had attempted to do with other drummers. I wrote out the program, and I was in between. They were transferring from tape to Pro Tools, and I see somebody's wrist knocking in the inside of the door. I'm like, come on in. And I'm on the phone with Don Was, his producer, and the person didn't come in. I scream, come on in. And it's Paul fucking McCartney. And I said to Don, I said, Don, I got to go, man. And he says, man. No, you know what Don says? Oh, man, the other guy was cooler. And I went, well, the other guy, he's talking about John. I said, well, John's dead. Bye. And
so
I'm going to talk to the guy who's alive.
Yeah.
And so, oh, my God, it was absolutely hilarious. He hung with us for an hour.
Yeah.
And I even remember going, I remember they were on the cover of Rolling Stone magazine, and I finally went, oh my God, congratulations, you're back on the cover of Rolling Stone. And I said, man, that record, and you got a new record called Number One Hits, I think.
Yeah.
And he goes like this, you know, I was listening to that record, you know, when they were putting it together, I went, those are some pretty damn good songs.
You
know, I wouldn't change a thing. And I'm like, you think? Oh my God, I was like dying. I was laughing my head off. Like,
so the Beatles were the ur point for Kenny Aronoff becoming a professional musician. But what about Jimi Hendrix? When did you first discover him?
He completely blew my head out. I put the Beatles to the side immediately. When Hendrix came out and I heard Purple Haze, that resonated with the 13-year-old that I was, or whatever age I was. And all of a sudden, oh my God. And the reason why Hendrix did it, it was a combination of blues, rock. It was dangerous, yet he was such a loving, peaceful, joyful guy.
Yeah.
So it was kind of like even your parents would tolerate it. He wasn't like, you know, goth rock or, you know, punk rock that was like dangerous and to parents or anybody that was a little bit. He was a gentle, kind man that had these just this kind of, you know.
Unless you gave him a can of lighter fluid, that is.
Well, yeah, I guess, but you stay. But he would probably tell you to stand back.
Yeah.
The thing is, I mean, it was safe, and I loved it. I remember 13, I think, we were having a party. I went to a little private school in New England. We all lived at home, but somebody was having a party, and we were all dancing to Beatles songs and like California Dreamin', you know, the Mamas and Papas.
Mamas and Papas, yeah.
And I remember I was going through getting more testosterone in my body. I'm like, you know, fuck this shit, man. I took off the 45 of California Dreamin' when everybody's close dancing, you know, and I put Purple Haze on. And I was like, this is the shit. And everybody turned around and looked at me, what are you doing? And rightfully so. I mean, these guys and these girls were dancing. And I'm like, you don't get it. And I went outside and completely tore apart the whole neighborhood, ripping signs down. I felt like nobody understood how heavy Jimmy was and what this meant to me. And I ripped all my posters down in my bedroom. And the only thing I had was Jimi Hendrix everywhere except for one poster. And that was with Jane Fonda.
I can see why. Probably Barbarella Jane Fonda.
Exactly. Exactly. And so Jimi Hendrix became my religion. Now, I remember that Christmas, I was listening to Are You Experienced on a turntable. I was in my room. I had a big, big room, bedroom, and me and my brother had HO cars and trains, you know, and I was building like a those balsa wood airplanes you could build. And I remember it was like 18 inches of snow. The fireplace is going downstairs. It's Christmas. And I'm toking a little bit on a joint. I'm building model airplanes, playing HO cars, and listening to Are You Experienced 24 hours. I mean, when I wasn't sleeping, it was side A, then side B, then side A, then side B. And my parents finally go, will you put something else on the turntable? And I went, no. And so he was religion to me. Eventually, when Axe's Bold as Love came out, I went and saw him play in Troy.
You did get to see him live.
Yeah, I saw him play up there near Albany, New York. One of my friend's dads, who was into music, drove us up there. And when I saw it, I didn't want anybody to talk to me. It was religion to me. And I remember they had a PA system. And by the way, it was, you know, which was Mitch Mitchell and Noel Redding. It was the original band. And they had a way of swirling the sound, like in a quadrant type
thing. So an early version of quadraphonic.
Okay. Yeah. So I just remember, you know, in Axis Bold of Love, you know, they had gotten into, you know.
The phasing. The phasing
thing. Yeah. And so I was experiencing that. Of course, we were stoned. And I was just like, it was religion to me. It was God.
Taking it to another world.
Yeah. And on the way home, I refused to talk to anybody. As a matter of fact, nobody talked to anybody because we were in so much shock and so blown away by what we had seen. And Jimi Hendrix was God to me. It was like, it was, but it was like I said, he was loving and dangerous at the same time.
Yeah, I've never thought of it that way, but you're absolutely right. You know, his personality is one of love and ease and down to earth and quiet.
Yeah.
We know that he was quite the devourer of sci-fi and things like that and was interested in, you know, the future of humanity and you know, and just trying to be along and get along with everybody. And then, of course, you know, his plane is incendiary. It's fire, literally fire. And so to take those two dual personalities and put them into one being, I guess, is pretty special. So thanks for sharing that with us. So, you know, I mean, obviously September 18th, 1970, do you remember hearing the news of his passing?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, what did that do for you? I mean, especially important. Yeah.
Devastated. It was as big as when John Kennedy died. Mm-hmm. It was big. You know, Janis Joplin died and Jim Morrison did, but when Hendrix died, oh, man, I was bummed out.
Yeah.
It was like, oh, man, this sucks, man. Yeah. What the fuck? And, you know, we have to realize that people were starting to experiment with drugs. Nobody of my peers had died before. And then three all at once. It was like, whoa, what's going on? And then you had the Kennedys and then Martin Luther King. But Hendrix was like, I was really fucking bummed me out big time.
So, you know, you go on to become a professional musician with a storied career. And it seems like, you know, while it started with the Beatles, like a lot of people, you know, that opens the door, it's Hendrix that really did it for you more so than just about anybody else. Yeah. And in fact, I think, you know, last year you performed with the Experience Hendrix Band, right?
Yeah, we were the final act of the whole show. It was me, Joe Satriani, and Doug
from King's X.
From King's X.
And yeah, it was great, man.
And, you know, I remember going to Joe and said, Joe.
Oh, wait a minute. You, Doug, and Joe. Oh, it is definitely the bald-headed guy.
The bald-headed.
I should be the fucking singer of that band.
Yeah, you should. I know. And, you know, exactly. And I just remember I said to Joe, listen, all the songs we're playing are, you know, Mitch Mitchell. He's a jazz drummer and he stretched out and, you know, really stretched out a lot. He says, are you cool with that? Because I try to honor, when you play music and it's, you know, Mitch Mitchell's a drummer, I try to honor every single thing he played. But Joe said, no, I will go do whatever the hell you want, push me. Mm-hmm. And so we took it out, man. I mean, it was a total, in the honor of Mitch Mitchell and the way he improvised on the drum set, because he was a jazz drummer.
Here's a quick word from our sponsors. We'll be back in a bit. And now back to the program.
Yeah. Was it all Experience songs that you guys did? You didn't do the Gypsies with Buddy Miles and all
well,
that?
Well, we added Machine Gun in the middle of one song.
Oh, yeah. Okay, that's band.
But we just added it in the middle. But who recorded Crossroads? cross town traffic.
That's Mitch Mitchell. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that's what I thought. So we did that. We did Voodoo Child. We did. We even did Third Stone from the Sun for a while, which I thought was awesome. And we did. What else? We did Manic Depression. And I Don't Live Today.
Yeah, okay.
Which is him. And we did a real, when it would stop, and we eventually stopped, and then Joe would start up again. It was so fast. And I'd go, and just go out. It's so out. People were like, what the,
Was that the first time that you were in like a Jimi Hendrix tribute band?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, no, I played Jimi Hendrix my whole life, but they're not.
But I mean, an actual sort of tour doing Jimmy.
First time.
Yeah.
First time.
Yeah, that must have felt really good to go to your hero and put it together, especially with Joe Satriani playing guitar, who could probably keep up with Jimmy pretty well, huh?
Oh, dude, that was one of the greatest. I'll never forget where I was standing. Mm-hmm. I was just started a summer tour with Fogerty, and we're in it. We did Atlantic City, and then we did Holmdel in Jersey. And I'm standing up on this grassy knoll, looking down at three tour trucks, the big semis.
Yeah.
And I get the call from what says on my phone, Mick Brigden, Chickenfoot. Because he was the manager.
Okay, Chickenfoot. Yeah.
He's the manager of Joe, but I listed him under Chickenfoot. And he goes, Kenny, Mick, how you doing, buddy? He says, and he got right to it. He says, listen, Joe is, we're doing this Experience Hendrix tour. Are you available I think it was next year in April. Or March, April, that kind of thing. And I said, you know what? Goddamn right.
I'll make myself available.
Right? I'm available without knowing whatever is going on. That's what I'm doing.
Yeah.
And I said, absolutely.
Very cool.
Then he said, and maybe then we'll do it again in the fall. And maybe there'll be a record in there. And I did Joe Satriani's record, which entered the Billboard charts at number 8 this year. Mm-hmm. But of course, we didn't tour. And I'm starting another record in my studio.
With Joe?
I'll be by myself, but it's for Joe.
Okay. All right. Yeah. So what does Jimmy's legacy mean to music, to current and future generations? What do you think that people should take away from it? He's been gone for 50 years.
Well, I mean, he's one of the few guys that reinvented guitar. First of all,
I'd say him and the guy we just lost.
Yes,
Eddie Van
exactly.
Halen. Yeah.
Yeah. Eddie. Yeah. Yeah. Those are the two big ones. And then the third one would be Jeff Beck. But those are the two guys that literally changed the face. And so everybody.
Yeah. There was a day before and literally a day after. I know what you mean. Yeah.
So, I mean, that'd be like nobody will ever sound like John Bonham. I mean, it's just uncanny how amazing everything he did. He was advanced, just a big old farm boy, but somehow he channeled something that you will always be chasing. And that's what's happened. That's what Jimmy is. You're never going to get it completely like him. You get close. Stevie Ray Vaughan, did his version. Other people have done their version. But so the cool thing about a guy like Jimi Hendrix, he isn't dead.
Yeah. No.
He never died. His physical body died, but he's alive.
And the music lives on. Yeah.
Yeah, and his style.
Yeah.
So people will always, there's always something to get from a guy like that. And there's only one guy who can do it like that. So everybody can learn from it and do their own thing. So it's he's never dead. Just like John Coltrane. He died, but oh my God. Who sounds like John?
Man. Yeah.
Nobody sounds like John Coltrane. Nobody. Yeah. Nobody sounds like Herbie Hancock. Hancock. Oh my God, body of work he did. And so, these people, they live on forever.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a special time in music. I'm not sure if we're in that world anymore. I think some of that has passed. You know, and let's face it, given this pandemic and, you know, what's going on, and, you know, we've lost a lot of great talent over the last few years as well, just due to age and all of that.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, where do you think Jimmy would be if he survived now?
Wow, who knows?
Yeah.
Who knows? You just don't know. I mean, if he was healthy, mentally, physically, emotionally, and spiritually, he'd be a wise man, and he'd probably have some incredible things to say because he's just older and wiser.
Yeah.
If he was healthy.
Good. That's good. I like that. Have you seen any of the tribute acts besides yourself that you know that are helping to keep that music alive, like Jimmy Blue, who's going to be the headliner of this event for Jimmy's 78th birthday on November 27th?
The only thing I ever saw was on that Hendrix Experience tour. Of course, I saw all these, even Zakk Wylde. I mean, you know, doing it. Or the great one was. What's his name from Megadeth?
Dave Mustaine.
Dave Mustaine. And he would come in our dressing room and humbly ask Joe stuff. And Joe is the sweetest guy in the world. And he would be telling Dave Mustaine, you know, how to, you know, approach some of this stuff. It was great.
Yeah.
It was so cool. I love that experience, watching people honor Jimi Hendrix's stuff. So that was actually, you know what? The first time I saw this, Hendrix. I was on tour with Melissa Etheridge. I was in San Diego, and this might have been the first year or second year because Mitch Mitchell was there and Buddy Miles was there, and they both played.
Wow.
And it was in San Diego.
Uh-huh.
I got to tell you, I have a Mitch Mitchell story.
Yeah.
I was at the Percussive Arts Society in Nashville, and I was on the cover of the magazine. Anyway, I get there, and there's Mitch Mitchell, and he looks at me, and he smiles at me and points to me, and I'm like, I look at him and I start pointing to me like, are you pointing
at me?
Or? And he shakes. Yeah, I turn around. I look behind me. And so he says, yeah. I come up to him. You know what he said? He says, I know something about you that most people don't know. And I thought, is this something related to a girl or something?
Oh, shit. Who did I get pregnant now?
Yeah, or something. He said, you know how to swing.
Yeah.
And you know what? I had just recorded with the Buddy Rich Big Band.
Really?
And I'd done two songs with them, the Straight No Chaser and Big Swing Face. And he had heard it.
Yeah.
And he went, because he was a jazz drummer. He was like, oh my God, you became this rock guy, but nobody really knows that you literally know how to swing. Cause I grew up playing jazz. And so, that to me was one of the greatest experiences.
I bet.
Oh my God. And then Buddy Miles.
That's one of your heroes telling you. You're cool, dude.
Oh yeah. I got the same thing from Ringo.
Yeah.
I got honored by Charlie Watts. But anyway, when Buddy was there, Buddy was in a wheelchair. He was a crazy guy. He was in a wheelchair popping wheelies with gold teeth, you know? And he looks at me and he starts acting like hitting hard like I do. And I'm pointing to me, and once again, I go, you talking to me? He says, yeah, man, you, yeah. He knew who I was. Dude, this is like, it doesn't get any better than that. That's it, man. These are my heroes, and I'm just a little kid in a little New England town. What the fuck? I didn't know that you could actually get out of there and become famous, and my heroes would know who I am. What? It was amazing.
Well, Kenny Aronoff, thanks so much for being with us on Deeper Digs to talk about Hendrix. Really appreciate it.
You're welcome, man. I'll talk about Hendrix anytime.
It's very far away. It takes about a half a day to get there. That's a wee chum by my dragonfly. Don't start his plane, baby. But all the same, you know it's a groovy. And the wind's just right.
Let's hear it for Kenny Aronoff. That guy is just so full of energy and good vibes. We could have talked for hours, and I promised him we'd have him back to talk in more detail on his long and storied career. Do go and get his great book, Sex, Drums, Rock and Roll, wherever you get your good reads. Okay, up next is a serious discussion on Hendrix as he relates to the black community. This is a very important book. Jimi Hendrix's Black Legacy, A Dream Deferred, is the culmination of a two-decade journey of author Corey Washington's exploration of Jimi Hendrix's complex and misunderstood relationship and impact on the black community. Jimi's life has been featured in, you know, numerous biographies over the years, but very little has been properly documented when it comes to his influence on people of color. Hendrix is often seen by many to have transcended race, which is a slap in the face to his deep cultural roots, concerning not only his black musical traditions, but simply growing up as a black person in the 40s and 60s. Corey seeks to add to Jimi's overall legacy by embracing Jimi's black culture, including the well-known people in Jimi's life, as well as the voices that many do not get to hear from in your traditional Jimi Hendrix biographies. It was always a strong desire of Jimi Hendrix to garner a more diverse fan base, although he never got to fully see the fruits of his labor. Jimi Hendrix's Black Legacy will reveal that his wish ultimately did come true. Now, Corey Washington is a high school history teacher currently teaching in Richmond County, Augusta, Georgia. He holds both a bachelor's and master's degree in middle grades education from Augusta State University, born in New York City in 1976. He's grown up in a cultural, racial melting pot. In the mid-1980s, he moved to Aiken, South Carolina, in the fifth grade. Ever since 1992, he has lived in Augusta, Georgia, and considers it a perfect fit. His love for history has spurred his love for writing. His other hobbies include playing and watching basketball, tennis and baseball, fishing, and above all, reading the Bible every day. All right, ladies and gentlemen, let's get to know Corey Washington.
So I bought my lid. Even messing with my children. And you're screaming at my wife. Get off of my bed. If you wanna get out of here alive. Freedom. That's what I want now. Freedom. That's what I need now. Freedom. To live. Freedom. So I can give.
Welcome with us now, Corey Washington. How you doing today, Corey?
I'm doing pretty good. How about yourself?
I'm fantastic. Let's start with your book, Jimi Hendrix, Black Legacy, A Dream Deferred. What caused you to write this?
Well, it's kind of interesting because I started from a position of a person that really didn't care that much for Hendrix. As I was growing up in the late 70s, early 80s in New York City, disco, hip hop, that was the main music. But you also had like the pop music of Michael Jackson, Prince, Whitney Houston, Lionel Richie. But Jimi Hendrix was never talked about.
Really?
So yeah, not in my household, not in my neighborhood, growing up in the projects. And so whenever I would see him, I really wouldn't think too much of him, but I'm sitting there watching wrestling because back in the day, I was a big wrestling fan with Hulk Hogan.
Oh, yeah.
The NWO. And he came to the ring with a Jimi Hendrix song. And I was like, man, this song is amazing. It was Voodoo Child, A Slight Return.
Right.
And it was that wah-wah scratch that got me. And so here it is. You know, the next day, I'm trying to find all of his music. And everything that I was listening to was great. And it just went from there. That was my initial beginning. And then I did a research paper when I was in college on why is Jimi Hendrix not as appreciated as he should be in the black community, you know, because I wanted to get into the dig deep on that. And that was the initial research. It led to my first book, Nobody Cages Me, which was kind of like an introductory book. And I just kept going on and on with the research, and the more stuff I found, the more interesting it became. And I had all of this wealth of knowledge and research, and I decided to do my latest book, Jimi Hendrix Black Legacy, A Dream Deferred.
Well, so look, you know, Jimi Hendrix looms large in rock and roll history, and anybody who delves into to that will find, you know, he is one of the pillars of the art form. You know, but why, to the central point of your question, why has he been, let's say, forsaken in the black community?
A lot of it had to do with marketing and perception. When he was alive, his management probably didn't know exactly how to market him to the black community. But as time went on, and it was towards the end of his career, he started doing things like the Band of Gypsies.
Yeah, yeah.
He brought in Billy Cox, which was a funkier bass player. And he gave a free concert in Harlem, September 5th, 1969. Mm-hmm. And so he started to kind of branch out, and black people started to be more receptive to him. But unfortunately, he wasn't alive too much after that.
Right. Yeah. It was the very tail end of his career. Mm-hmm.
And so I think if he was alive, it would have been a lot different. But, you know, unfortunately, it didn't happen like that.
Yeah, I can see that. You know, he definitely was. Well, of course, you know, let's face it. He had to go to the UK to even make it. He couldn't make it here in America. You know, and I'm sure there were racial components as to why that was. Chaz Chandler, you know, ex-bass player of the Animals, found him in New York and said, look, let's get you over to the UK where that problem is much less so. And he was accepted pretty quickly, especially by the musicians. I mean, it was only a couple of weeks before his first performance there, Bag of Nails, where, you know, all the premier English musicians came and literally left in sweats trying to figure out how to keep up with the guy, right?
Right. I mean, the English have always had a reputation for attaching themselves to great black music. Jimi Hendrix was an originator, but he was also cut from the same cloth as those old bluesmen that they looked up to all the time. So here you had this guy who was an old soul, but he was innovative as far as his techniques. And once he got over there and started using those pedals and doing, I mean, that's where the innovation was in guitar at that time in England. So he was in the right spot.
Yeah, yeah. Marshall was fairly new. The pedals were just being invented. You know, a master of distortion, obviously. Right. You know, these things all kind of coincide in a timing that plays very well with his style of playing. But to your point, you know, hey, look, he grew up, you know, in the projects in Seattle. And, you know, was, you know, treated to, you know, the racism that existed, maybe less so on the far West Coast than you might find in the Jim Crow South of his early upbringing, being that he was born in the mid 40s. And, you know, that continued to exist well into the late 60s and, you know, is even in some ways still with us today, unfortunately.
Right.
He was able to transcend that. But to your point, He you know, he did so primarily by becoming a star to a white audience. And it wasn't until later in his career that he did start to say, hey, wait a minute, you know, I need to get closer to my roots, hence bringing Billy Cox in, the rest of the Band of Gypsies, and even the possibility of him, I know there was a possible record with Miles Davis even thought about, right?
Right. Miles Davis, he was getting into that whole jazz fusion thing. He was pioneering that. He was, I mean, even after he died, the musical artist that took up after him, P-Funk, Funkadelic, Prince, Ernie. Yeah,
Prince is a pretty obvious one. I remember the day I kind of saw Prince play guitar, which I got to see very early, and was like, holy shit, that guy's like Jimi Hendrix, and he is that good of a guitar player. A lot of people don't remember that.
He tried to deny it. He tried to, I guess, like you said, it was so obvious that he tried to deny it for a little bit and say, oh, I take after Carlos Santana. But when you see all that purple on Prince and you see that frilly clothing he was wearing, you have to think about Jimi Hendrix.
Yeah, and to give Prince his due, you know, there's definitely some James Brown going on in there. There's definitely some P-Funk going on in there. I mean, he took from all the greats and created something new, which, you know, all hail Prince, you know. But back to Jimmy, I guess to your point is that had he survived into you know, full adulthood. And you know, I mean, here we're talking about him. He would be 78 years old this year, which is what, you know, we're talking about this celebration of his 70th birthday here at the end of November, November 27th. You know, you think that maybe the Black community would have accepted him more? He would have been more of a pillar to later musical moments. Is that what the suggestion is?
I would say so. I think that a lot of my research was kind of surprising in that Jimi Hendrix actually had 5 albums in the top 10 mm-hmm. on the R&B charts on a Billboard. And that's something that doesn't get reported a lot. But I mean, Band of Gypsies album stayed on the charts, on the R&B charts for like over a year, mm-hmm. as well as Are You Experienced. So there was a lot of Black people supporting Jimi Hendrix, but
it didn't translate to later generations, I think is your main point here.
Right. And even now there's been a little resurgence. When you speak to people about Jimi Hendrix, younger people, a lot of these rappers have sampled his music. A lot of the influential rappers love Jimi Hendrix, like Drake, mm-hmm. Future. You know, these are some of these young people look up to these guys, and they're talking about Jimi Hendrix. Andre 3000 played him in a movie.
Oh, recently. Yeah, very well, right. Yeah.
So I'm starting to see an uptick, you know, that's very encouraging.
Yeah, that's very encouraging. And I think maybe, you know, if I can, you know, in the mid to late 60s, you know, at the peak of Jimmy's career, you know, we just here in America had passed the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act. Things seemed to be getting better racially in this country. Of course, that was only on the surface. We know there was a vicious backlash that was coming. And I think, you know, music of the 60s was more, you know, there was plenty of Black artists and white artists that would play together. It would be multiple bills. There was less of this separation of music. But in the 70s, and I think a lot of it's driven by, you know, white flight and the backlash that occurred after the advances of the mid-60s, that you started to see this separation. There was Black music on one side again and white music on another side again. And it's not until maybe, you know, disco, you see a little bit of cross-pollination at that point, but certainly it's not until the 80s where, you know, white and Black music start commingling again, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, and even with disco, you had that rock backlash against that.
Yeah. Mostly driven by white people. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, and I think, like you said, Prince, Michael Jackson, those artists, when they were major crossover artists, you started seeing the lines blur. But Jimi Hendrix could have been that first true crossover artist, I believe, but it never happened for some of the reasons we already spoke about. But
yeah.
I mean, nowadays, just like music is almost genreless, but the radio stations are still segregated because they have these niches that they only play certain things. So we're back to that same old thing again.
Yeah, that is a shame. You know, it's just I think it may be a little bit different. I think it's just there's just a plethora of artists out there that, you know, find anybody's tastes, you know, so it's a little bit harder to kind of point and say, ah, here is the real stuff, when there's just a, you know, to start with, a sea of mediocrity, and very few, even those that do pump up out of that sea to get recognized, you know, they've got a lifespan of a gnat of like 24, 48 hours before some other news item shows up and replaces them with another song or artist. So it's a little bit harder for somebody to grab hold of the public's imagination, kind of like Jimmy did back in the late 60s. So I think it's a little bit harder on that side of things. But I do see, you know, the younger generations, you know, again, you know, we are constantly, you know, bending the arc of justice, bending the arc of history towards justice. And, you know, it seems like the younger generation listens to all kinds of music, and they you know, they kind of, you know, don't really feel strongly about one or the other. I'm seeing, you know, a progression, if you will, a positive progression of that.
Right. I think things like YouTube, Spotify, and all these different platforms where they can just type an artist in and listen to this, to their discography. Yeah. We didn't have that when we were coming up. We know, no, we had to do it the old fashioned way, but these kids now, they can do it in the blink of an eye. And that really helps them out as far as discovering classical music. And just very good.
Well, I think of, you know, I you know, being in a technology environment, podcasting like myself, you know, we get asked a lot, you know, how we're helping or affecting the music industry, you know, and I point to, you know, the TikTok here with Dreams, which I'm sure you've seen. You know, some kid, you know, guy riding a skateboard with a cranberry juice, and that turns into some giant meme that causes that song to come back into the Billboard charts. Or the twins, the two African-American twins that probably have more of a hip-hop background, and they've never listened to classic rock, and they put on a classic rock song. You know, In the Air Tonight's the most famous one, and that bit goes viral, and that song is now back in the top 10 as well. It's crazy that you know, we're getting that. But back to Jimi Hendrix specifically. Out of this book, you're also trying to make a documentary, right?
Right. This is a recent project of mine. A lot of people don't read books, and I think this documentary will be something where I'll be able to go into areas that no other Jimi Hendrix documentary has ever gone in, and interview the people that not just only knew him, but also people that were influenced by him that never knew him, but just kind of painting this whole picture and show how his influence really went beyond the rock world and went into R&B and funk and soul and jazz and all this other stuff. And I, the way I have it mapped out, I think it'll be very compelling for people to watch.
Mm-hmm. Which then should drive people to go and read the book, which will have the deeper detail into it. So, I know you also are involved in trying to help get the Band of Gypsies inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I think they've been inducted into the R&B Hall of Fame, if I remember right. But the Rock Hall hasn't, accepted Band of Gypsies just yet.
Right. We first, when I first started it, it was entitled Induct the Band of Gypsies into the Rock and R&B Hall of Fame. Another guy, Boo O'Connor, he was essential in helping. Once we got the Band of Gypsies inducted into the R&B Hall of Fame, we dropped that part off and just kept the rock. So I think that just going around and getting different opinions from people like Bootsy Collins, George Clinton, and any other person that we can, and putting it on the Facebook site, just kind of bringing light, because I got a video on YouTube that's the top 10 reasons to induct the Band of Gypsies into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And I got a countdown, and I mean, they just were so influential. I mean, of course their album was double platinum. So they had the sales, but you know, just because they were short lived, I don't think that should disqualify them from being inducted, you know, when you compare them to maybe some of the other people that are already in there.
I don't think this is too much of a stretch. I mean, you know, we all know that Jimi Hendrix is, like I said, one of the pillars of rock and roll. He's inducted into the Hall of Fame as that. He will never be forgotten. He looms large there. So, you know, like others who have, you know, two or more inductions, it's not inconceivable that Band of Gypsies could find itself in there. There's a campaign, obviously, that needs to happen, and that's basically what rock bands have to do to get the attention of the Rock Hall Committee that, you know, puts them on the ballot, and then, of course, the voters themselves that that make the final submission. So you said you have 10 reasons. Can you give us the 10 reasons?
Let's see, the 10 reasons that the Band of Gypsies should be inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I know one of the biggest reasons is that when you look at the influence of the Band of Gypsies, they were head and shoulders as far as a lot of these other groups, as far as influence and not just rock, but also R&B. Look at the groups that came after that. Also, if I could just go through this quickly, number 10, Buddy Miles should already be in for his previous body of work with his other groups. Billy Cox should have been inducted when they inducted the Jimi Hendrix Experience. If they would have waited two more years, he could have got in according to their rules. Mm-hmm. Jimi Hendrix is, like you said, one of the greatest influences, and he deserves to be inducted multiple times. I mean, Eric Clapton is in there three times. Why not Jimi Hendrix more than once?
I got you there, my friend. I got you there.
I don't have to down Eric Clapton, but I think people know what I'm talking about.
Right. If Eric can be in there three times, Jimmy can be there at least twice. Right.
Yeah. I mean, the exclusive content from those songs that the Band of Gypsies had, they were different from the Jimi Hendrix Experience and were never duplicated again. So we're looking at two separate groups here. Another one, the tremendous impact on communities of color in the inner city. You ask a lot of Black people and they say, this is the reason why I got into Jimi Hendrix. Why? The Band of Gypsies. So that was huge. Machine Gun. Just look at that one song. It had the greatest guitar note of all time. It's a classic.
Oh, I mean, if you want to get yourself taken back to Vietnam and what all that meant, just put Machine Gun on.
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. And the overall concert that the live album came from was One for the Ages. I think there were four concerts. But I mean, we've had like songs for Groovy Children and different things where we can listen to all the concerts and just see how great that music was. So that's another reason. Like I said, great commercial success, record sales, double platinum. I think they had a documentary that sold a million copies. So, I mean, this is stuff people are interested in.
Right.
Of course, the lasting impact on the world of music. I think that's probably the number one reason why they should be inducted.
Without doubt, you make a strong case, Corey. And you, I understand, have the support of the Hendrix Estate itself, right?
Well, when I went to the originally, Jimi Hendrix was supposed to accept his award because Jimi Hendrix was inducted as a solo artist in 2016 at the R&B Hall of Fame. She couldn't make it, so I went in her place and accepted the award and gave a speech that she sent me. And the same thing in 2019 when the Band of Gypsies. So I have been working with the estate as far as that's concerned. So, but I haven't heard much from them on the rock and roll. I don't know if they're doing their own thing on that end.
Hey, it takes a village to get anything done, right? So as long as good people are doing it from various angles, actually, you probably have more of a chance of succeeding that way. So so that would work. All right. So I understand you you know Jimmy Blue, who will be the headliner at the 78th birthday celebratory event. Tell us about working with Jimmy and what your thoughts are about his Kiss the Sky project.
Well, I initially got to know Jimmy through Facebook, like so many in the Hendrix community, and we would talk back and forth, and he enjoyed my research, and I enjoyed what he was doing at the time with his radio show, Code Blue. Mm-hmm. I used to listen to that show religiously when it came on, because he would do all these different genres, and I mean, I would just love it, and you would always learn something. And he would always play Hendrix. He would always play James Brown. He would always play Sly. And those are like three of my favorite artists. And so actually, I finally got to meet him in New York City a couple of times and hang out with him. And I mean, one time we just talked for like 5-6 hours. I mean, just going back and forth and sharing Hendrix knowledge. And man, when I got to see him play with Kiss the Sky, I mean, it was like blown away. I mean, you could look at the faces of the people in the audience. They were eating it up. And so I got to see him at the Cafe Y one time in the Greenwich Village, and I got to see him at the Brooklyn Bowl. That was my most recent time seeing him. And both times, I mean, it was the costumes, I mean, everything down to a T. So I definitely encourage everybody out there to look up Kiss the Sky, and if you get a chance, go see him in public once this pandemic dies down.
Yeah, it's probably, you know, the best, he's probably the best Hendrix tribute act, you know, out there going these days. He fully embraces the role. He looks a little like the man as it is, and he plays quite a bit like him as well. So yeah, it's great, and you know, I'm just grateful that people like yourself and Jimmy, you know, are out there continuing to expose people to, you know, this guy who, you know, only had a short career, but an incendiary career regardless, right?
Right. Right. We look at it from a scholarly point of view. We're serious about our research. We want to present accurate details, and we don't want to rehash the same old stuff that's already out there, because you can go look that stuff up in a book. So what we try to do is go into detail and find things that nobody's talking about and bring those points out.
Yeah. It, like what we do here, rock and roll archaeology, you know, we're digging up the past, and we're looking at, you know, now with history's perspective, we can kind of put things together in a way that is, you're unable to do in real time. You know, we have perspective and, you know, the advantage of time to see how these things played out and how significant these players are. And, you know, here we are, almost 50 years from Jimmy's passing, and you know, we're still talking about him, and he is still important to the musical landscape out there, and that's pretty incredible.
Exactly. People are still learning about him. People that don't know who he is, people that have known him for, I mean, I've been one of the most encouraging things about my book is that I've had people that are way older than me that have been studying Hendrix from like the 60s say, you know what, I thought I knew everything about Jimi Hendrix, but after reading your book, I learned quite a few things, and that really is encouraging.
Well, we hope many of our listeners go out and get your latest book, Jimi Hendrix, Black Legacy, A Dream Deferred, and even your previous book I had.
Nobody Cages Me.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. All right. Corey Washington, thanks so much for being with us on Deeper Digs to talk about Jimi Hendrix and his legacy, especially when it comes to the Black community.
Thanks for having me, Christian. I really enjoyed it.
People talking, but they just don't know what's in my heart and why I love you so. I love you, baby, like a mine of love gold. Come on, sugar, let the good time roll. Hey!
So awesome to have Corey Washington with us today talking Jimi Hendrix. I was so happy to hear that the man is being taken back by the Black community. Let's face it, Jimmy had to deal with all the same racist bullshit African Americans have had to suffer in America. Let's never forget that fact. All right. Friday, November 27th at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 4 p.m. at West, Kiss the Sky presents a live stream of their annual Jimi Hendrix Birthday Bash direct from the historic Bearsville Theater in Woodstock, New York. Check out the bearsvilletheater.com or at Kiss the Sky Tribute page on Facebook for more information. And remember, it's donation only, so you just gotta go. Mark your calendars for November 27th and come celebrate what would have been Jimi Hendrix's 78th birthday with me and a whole host of folks. All right, next week we have two more Jimi Hendrix fans and players. I'm not sure who will be next, but I have on deck Carmine Appice, Gerardo Velez, Billy Cox, Mickey Dolenz, Vernon Reid, and of course I'll end with Jimmy Blue from Kiss the Sky. There may be some more too, we'll see. Okay, that's it for this week. So go out and make sure to keep up the rockin'. We'll be right back.
Deeper Digs is hosted by Christian Swain. Produced by Christian Swain and Peter Farioli. Sound designed by Busy Signal Studios. Engineered by Jerry Danielson, Christy O'Donnell, and Leslie Barker. Find all of our shows, notes, and social links at pantheonpodcast.com. Contact us on social at Pantheon Podcast on Facebook and Instagram. Tweet us at Pantheon Pods. All songs can be found used in this podcast for purchase or streaming wherever you get your great music. Please pick up these amazing tracks.
Do something fun with the family. Come downtown and go to the Auto Show January 20th through the 22nd at the CHI Health Center. Get inside the newest cars, trucks, and SUVs and see some of the hottest electric cars like the Hyundai Ioniq 5. Race a NASCAR remote control car. See beautiful classic cars and visit the Subaru Pet Adoption. Free admission for veterans on Friday. Get out and go to the Auto Show January 20th through the 22nd. Find more at omahaautoshow.com.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Fernino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune into Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.